You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, an award-winning Christmas decorator from Milwaukee shares tips on making an impressive holiday lights display and saving money while we're at it. Now, one of the best-reviewed movies of the last year has ties to the Badger State. Pig stars Nicolas Cage as a reclusive truffle hunter who sets out to rescue his pig after it's stolen. The story takes place in Portland, Oregon, but the director hails from Wisconsin. Michael Sarnowski is the director and co-writer of Pig, his first feature-length film, which is now streaming on Hulu. He recently talked to Central Time's Dean Kinetter.
Michael, you're from here in Wisconsin, just outside of Milwaukee. When you were growing up here, what first got you interested in movies and making films?
I think the earliest experience I had with it was, I think, University School of Milwaukee. They had a summer camp that had a film course where I think we were just using iMovie and little handy cams I think Drew Maxwell was the teacher of that. I still remember him. He worked at the school as well, and we would just make little movies over the summer. I think I was probably in like sixth grade or something, that was my first experience realizing that, you know, films were something you could make and that there was a craft to it and that you would set up the camera in different areas and all that sort of thing. But then after that, it was a gradual process of, you know, different teachers and my mom being really encouraging of it. It was never really something I pursued beyond a hobby. It was just kind of something I would do with my friends. And I didn't think that it was sort of a career that I could pursue. So that didn't come until much later. But early on, I had enough teachers and people that were supportive of that passion that it was a hobby that I got to explore.
What led you to make the jump from looking at it as a hobby to an actual profession?
Mostly time. I mean, it wasn't until senior year of college that I really shot my first, I mean, I wouldn't exactly say professional film, but it was a film with more than just me and a handy cam. I had a couple friends who were, you know, being crew members and we had lights and sound and all that sort of stuff. And that was the first time that I ever shot something that felt more professional. And that was when I was kind of like, oh, maybe this is something I could kind of pursue outside of college as more than just a hobby. But then it took me some years to kind of feel like I had deserved or could be in sort of Hollywood. It seemed very far away from me. I didn't have any contacts in the industry. So it was, you know, it was a good chunk of my 20s just kind of wandering around LA and in the dark, not literally in the dark, but just trying to figure out like what people wanted from me. And then I think it wasn't until I kind of stopped worrying about what people wanted from me and just started focusing on trying to really write something that meant something to me, that I finally kind of had, my big break. That was Pig, when I wrote something that just was kind of just for me, just something that really spoke to me. I mean, that's sort of a sloppy answer, but it took time to kind of believe in myself and feel like it was an option.
Let's turn to the movie Pig. On the most basic level, it's a story about a truffle hunter who sets out to rescue his kidnapped truffle pig. But beyond that, it's this really thoughtful story about grief and loss and how we, you know, fill the voids in our life when we lose people that we love. When you were writing the film, what came first? Was it the premise or was it that theme?
The first thing was the premise. The first thing was just this image of this old man in the woods with his truffle pig. That was something that I had kind of had in a notebook somewhere for a while as just an image that stood out to me. I didn't know much about truffles, but there was just something about that, I think the writing process was about unpacking why that image was so moving to me. And then it was through unpacking that I think I found kind of my own thematic stuff from my life that fed into why that was so meaningful to me. And then I started getting into, you know, my dad passed away when I was a kid, and I was at this time in my late 20s when I had sort of seen how that had shaped my life and shaped the lives of my family members and how that had changed how we kind of interacted with the world and the sort of, you know, the sort of theory of like self relative to society that we had built around that loss. And so the story ended up becoming very much about different people who had kind of shaped their identity around loss in different ways. Um, So, you know, it kind of starts with a premise, but then as you explore that, you kind of see what naturally is coming from you in that.
We're talking with Michael Sarnowski right now, Wisconsinite and director and co-writer of the new film Pig. And Michael, something I really enjoyed about the movie was that it doesn't tell you everything it could. You know, we learn things about the characters' backstories, but there's still plenty of room for us as an audience to think and to kind of fill in the blanks for ourselves. How do you decide what to leave out of a script when you're writing it?
I mean, some of it's trial and error. Some of it you don't decide until you're editing the actual film clips. But for me, kind of my philosophy on it with this project, and I mean, in a lot of my writing, I like the idea that you never really know more about the world than your main character does. So we're going through this from Rob's point of view, and you never really know more than he does, and then beyond that, you never really know more about him than the world does at any given point. We just kind of pick up in the moment and have to kind of figure it out as we go along. And I don't know, there's something about that style of writing that appeals to me. I think it kind of feels how living feels, and that was kind of my guide for how to approach that. But then beyond that, yeah, I didn't. It's not a movie about grief in the moment. It's not a movie about all the nitty-gritty of what happened and why and all of that. It's kind of about the lingering effects of those things. So you don't really need to know all the details to appreciate that on an emotional level. Because I think when you're dealing with someone and when you're getting to know someone that, you know, has some kind of tragedy, or I mean, we all have some kind of loss in our past that we're kind of trying to, you know, shape ourselves around or protect ourselves from. I think we're never going to know those immediate things. So we just kind of have to take people at face value and try and connect off of what we can understand.
And speaking of that main character, you were able to cast Nicolas Cage in the lead for this film, Oscar winner, and someone whose acting style over the course of his career has ranged from, kind of over the top to very serious, dramatic work. What was it like to work with and direct Nick Cage?
It was surprisingly easy. I wish I had some kind of crazy story to tell, but really, I mean, he read the script. His agents came across the script and became really enthusiastic about it. And he read it and really understood it, really understood the character, really understood the tone of it. So I wasn't having to, you know, wrangle him or make him go smaller or anything like that. Like he really got it on an emotional level. And I think really everyone involved understood it. And so I, you know, it just felt like we were kind of on the same team. He wasn't a diva. He was very professional and collaborative and respectful. I mean, this was my first feature, so he could have, you know, pulled rank and said, "This is the Nick Cage show," but he didn't do that at all. He was very respectful, very much, you know, what does the director want? What is their vision? How do I support that? How do we make this thing happen together? So he was really just a joy to work with, and I don't know. I just really felt like he was a teammate.
Now, Michael, you've gotten this story out there. It's been well received. If there's someone listening in Wisconsin who has a story they want to tell, whether that's through film or writing or visual art, whatever it may be, but is still thinking about whether to actually, create it and put it out there, what advice would you have for them?
I mean, it sounds hokey, but I would just say go for it. I mean, I think I thought there were all these barriers into the industry, and there are, but for me, the thing that ended up working was just kind of writing something that I cared about. And I wrote Pig initially to shoot it for very little money, and just kind of, I wrote it as like, okay, if I just have to make my own feature film and just make it happen, I could make this film happen. I could do it guerrilla style. But then, you know, we got some really talented actors involved, and it kind of grew and it became a more legitimate thing. But, you know, I wrote it with the intention of just making it happen if I had to. And I think just think about what you can pull off right now and just try to pull it off. Stop waiting for people to tell you what you should do or can do, and just think about what you want to do.
It's a good place to leave it. Michael, congrats on the film and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Michael Sarnowski is a film director and writer from Wisconsin. He talked to Central Time's Dean Kinetter about his film Pig, which came out earlier this year. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary-Kate McCoy with a story about roadside attractions.
Author Eric Dragne has been a keen observer of roadside attractions for years. He recently wrote the book, The Impossible Road Trip, that chronicles the most famous stops across the U.S. And believe it or not, Wisconsin is home to some of the quirkiest. Dragney takes us on a tour of the best roadside attractions across the state.
I was born in the shadow of the world's largest six-pack in La Crosse. My mom told me later that the nurses in the hospital there even gave her a beer to help bring the milk. Despite this, I realized I'd never conquer the world's largest six-pack, since those six silos hold enough beer to provide one person a six-pack a day for 3,351 years. Being born in Wisconsin, I just assumed these gigantic sculptures of everyday objects were destined to take their rightful place along the roadside to lure in visitors. Then I lived in Italy with all the supposedly tasteful statues and architecture. Later, when Italian friends came to visit me in the Midwest, I tried to show off our impressive architecture. The old churches, the Capitol. They'd respond, "You know, these are all just imitations of Italian buildings. You have seen St. Peter's in Rome, no?" With this in mind, I resolved to show my own kids what is truly American. We set out on the Wisconsin byways. We saw talking cows, rusty dinosaur statues, and too many mice eating cheese to count. A giant bucky badger in Burnham Wood is now half buried next to signs promising hot girls, cold beer. We got lost in the labyrinth of House on the Rock near Spring Green and discovered Dr. Evermore near Baraboo, who gave us a tour of his Forevertron, a Jules Verne-esque steampunk rocket ship before he blasted off into the heavens. A trip into the kitsch world of Wisconsin Dells never disappoints. Except when we discovered that Tommy Bartlett's robot world was brought into the 21st century with no more cheesy 1970s evil robot slaves, and Xanadu, the foam house of tomorrow, has been unceremoniously discarded. Perhaps all that hardened foam from Xanadu was repurposed as the new giant Roman Colosseum next to the upside-down White House. Why just look at some ancient Greek statues and sterile museums when you can drive a go-kart through the belly of a six-story tall Trojan horse? The best of Wisconsin's roadside attractions come from a burning desire by an obsessed individual to create giant monuments to prove that I was here, like Fred Smith's Concrete Park in Phillips. Even better are those that are the result of a practical joke, such as Rhinelander's Hodag, an elaborate hoax based on the capture of a mythical monster with photos that ran on the front page of newspapers across the country. This is not normal behavior, thank God. And Wisconsin is full of it. Midwestern tourist bureaus drool over the idea of a lucrative roadside attraction, but the best sites are seldom devised by a committee in a boardroom. The creators are artistic visionaries, scorned as kooks and crazies, but are the very ones who give our towns character. Why raise statues to some self-important governor when you can create your own idol, like the 143-foot-long muskie in Hayward? Wouldn't you rather see that than some dusty old Roman statue that's missing its arms? Many of these fiberglass artifacts were born in Sparta at the Fast Company. They made Hayward's muskie, and also a 55-foot half-man, half-peapod Jolly Green Giant in Minnesota, and a 38-foot-tall Holstein in North Dakota that is visible for 5 miles. My family and I visited their graveyard of discarded statues and seriously considered buying an enormous big boy for our front yard. What would the neighbors say? Instead, we put our ambitions aside, realizing we could never compete with the original grandeur of La Crosse's monument to beer.
Eric Dragney is the author of the new book, The Impossible Road Trip, about America's most famous roadside attractions. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, we'll get some advice on how to dress up our homes for the holidays while keeping costs to a minimum. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're about a week and a half away from Christmas. If you decorate your yard, you probably already have your lights and other displays out in the front yard for all to see. If not, you've still got time to set things up. And if you don't have a giant Santa, light-up reindeer, or a nativity scene, try making your own. Along with her husband, our next guest has been dressing up her house with her homemade Christmas decorations for decades and winning some awards in the process. She's here to share some of her secrets behind the magic. Nancy Bazin is a resident of South Milwaukee. We talked to her earlier today. Nancy, thanks so much for joining us today.
No problem. It's my pleasure.
Well, paint us a picture, first of all, if you would. What do you have up in your front yard this year?
Well, this year we've toned down decorations a little bit from what we used to do, but this year we still have a theme, which we always tend to do. We have a Santa in a boat, and he's directing reindeers, and we've added on the other end from him, we've added a polar bear with a penguin fishing. And between them, we laid down a tarp of blue plastic, which looks like a river. Behind them, we have like a little camping set. We've got a teepee that my husband made with a little lighted dog coming out, and we've got two elves that they're sitting between, they're between them is like a fire. We've got those bulbs that kind of look like they're flickering, and we made sticks standing up. And so they're kind of like camping along the river. So it's kind of, like I said, all tied in. And that's, you know, besides the lights, of course, and spotlights and stuff, that's pretty much our display. But it's all theme-oriented, which is something we've always done.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. You've won awards for your yard displays, and it seems like the theme is really important. That's what separates the award winner from somebody who just throws a whole bunch of stuff that they bought in the front yard. How important is it to have that theme for you?
For us, it's always been theme-oriented, no matter what, like, when we first started, we had a Santa suit, and that's from trying to be Santa when the kids were little. So what we had done from there is we used it to stuff him. And our first, very, very first theme was we had a in our yard, and it wasn't on a very busy street, but my husband had built like a little A-frame treehouse for our kids. So we got the idea of stuffing Santa, and he's crawling up the ladder. And then below him, my husband did life-size, like, reindeer. You know, we had logs from our place up north and stuff. And so they were, like, eating hay below. So that kind of started out. It's kind of the theme. You know, he's going up either to rest or visit the kids that are sleeping in the house. And then we went from there. And it would be, we tended to use our Santa Claus pretty much in everything. And we stuffed that suit, whether we had him sitting at a table or at a desk, rather. And then we went and stuffed kids' clothes, like snow suits and stuff. And they were standing in line to sit on Santa's lap. That's what it was. He was sitting on a chair and they were standing in line. So we've kind of always gone around that way. Santa, like I said, that suit went many, many years. It withstood all of the all of the weather, and again, just as well as the clothes that we would get to stuff our kids. Then from kids, we've added elves. Okay, so we did that with stuffed like red pants or green pants, anything we could find at weather rummage sales or stuff like that. As we progressed, one of the things we used is in trying to keep things stuffed is we used a styrofoam head, because you could put the hats on them. You could put scarves around their faces, because none of them really had faces. You know, you kind of turned them to the side, but you could always tell what they were. We always did them life size. So that kind of was the theme through the year, either bringing in elves and always having Santa and using stuffed clothes and things like that.
You it's not just stuffing the clothes. You make, and over the years you've made a lot of your props and decorations as opposed to buying them. What got you into that sort of do-it-yourself angle?
Well, you know, my husband is very, very handy. And even though sometimes he makes faces when I would come up with ideas, a couple days later he would always go, oh, we can do this. So as we progressed, you know, you find different things come out to use. So what he did to make things easier for our figures would be he made kind of a stick person. So you had that stick going up so you could put the styrofoam head. And then you had kind of like stick arms that you could dress, and then the arms could be, you know, the arms could be molded. Same thing with the feet. You could put the pants on. So as we progressed, that's what we used as far as our people went. As far as the rest of the decorations, we would use stuff like we would cut out, let's say plywood, or it's not fiberboard, but something like that. And then we would paint it. We made lollipops, okay, with the spirals. We used those all around a skating rink that we had. And then the next year we would use those lollipops in a different kind of a themed thing. So some of our things that we made carried through to the, you know, we carried them through to the next year. We always tried to reuse whatever we can, but make it a different theme.
When do you have to start doing all this work to have it ready by December?
Well, you know what? We weren't always like, oh, doing this stuff in summer. Summer got to be busy. So I'd love to say, oh my God, we planned all year. We didn't. We would do it, you know, we would do it just as we had time. So sometimes the stuff was started, you know, maybe early part of November, you know what I mean? It always got done, but the ideal thing would be plan what you can. But, you know, life gets busy, so it just depends on what time you have. But I do believe that if you have the time to start it when it is nice weather and everybody can be involved and you're not out there freezing your fingers and your toes and your nose, that's the best thing to do.
You mentioned the weather. It's not going to be so nice today. What do you do when you know some heavy winds are blowing in?
Well, especially with the inflatables, we already have them extra tied anyway. Because, you know, what's the theme if you don't have the inflatable or it's sideways or Santa's on his head or, you know, or the boat like we have is capsized. We do have it tied down in a bunch of different ways, like added stability. But now with something like this, it would just be foolish. There's no reason to turn around and wreck, you know, we've got the whole season yet. So we just don't put anything with inflatable. We don't. And anything that's kind of, say, more stabilized that, you know, isn't blowing up, you just kind of make sure you have it tied down. That's, I guess you do the best you can do because you don't want to put all that work up and have it be gone or in the neighbor's yard and have them taking credit for it.
Just in our last few moments, are you thinking about next year already?
You know what? We kind of all, it depends on what I see. This is all, you know, what can we add? What can we improve on? So it's kind of something that just comes along as I see it or think about it.
Nancy, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very, very much, and Merry Christmas.
And to you, too.
Thank you.
Nancy Bazin is a South Milwaukee resident. We talked to her about her and her husband's award-winning homemade Christmas decorations. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, with concern about inflation, the Federal Reserve is looking at possible action. We'll get the basics on what the Fed is, what it does, and what it can do when it comes to inflation. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, climate change is having an impact on Wisconsin's cranberry farmers. A crop scientist tells us how growers can adapt. First, the U.S. voted last night to recommend criminal contempt charges against former Trump White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. That's after Meadows reversed on an agreement to cooperate with the House committee investigating the January 6th insurrection. Before the reversal, Meadows had turned over records to the committee, including text messages he exchanged with conservative figures on the day of the Capitol attacks. The committee released some of those messages to the public this week, and now some are saying the messages show a disparity between how Trump allies have talked about the riots privately versus in public. It's the Week in Washington. We'll talk about that story and more. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Trump allies and former staff members be cooperating with this investigation, or do you agree that they shouldn't testify? What do you make of how Trump allies were talking about January 6th in private versus what they said in public? What do you want to see happen to the people who helped plan the January 6th insurrection? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Amanda Turkel is the Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. Amanda, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Can you talk us through how this vote shook out last night?
Sure. Well, not surprisingly, it broke down basically along party lines. Democrats voted to hold Mark Meadows in contempt, and Republicans voted against it, except for two Republicans, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who are both, you know, they've both been Trump critics, and they serve on the January 6th committee investigating all this. So it's not surprising that they aligned themselves with Democrats.
And what's the significance of former White House Chief of Staff being recommended for criminal contempt charges? We've also seen some other figures, including Steve Bannon, referred, but this is a highly placed official, or was, in the Trump administration.
Right, and I think for some people, you know, Bannon seems honestly an obvious case. He wasn't working in the White House at the time. His claims to executive privilege are sort of baffling. Again, he didn't work in government. you know, Mark Meadows is, I think, a slightly more complicated case. He was White House chief of staff. He, you know, arguably has some claim to executive privilege. But I think what his, you know, I think what the committee is saying is that he, you know, had already been cooperating. He said he would cooperate. He was handing over documents, including text messages and emails. He has written a book where he obviously tells quite a bit about, you know, what he was doing in the White House, but he refuses to sit down for an interview. And so that is why Congress decided to hold him in contempt, because he basically, they're saying, stopped cooperating. And so, you know, is all of this subject to executive privilege when he's already handed over so much and he's been writing this book? And I think, you know, that's what I think that Congress, you know, the Democratic Party and these Republicans determined that, you know, he doesn't have a case. And now it's up to the Justice Department about whether they want to pursue the contempt referral.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost, Washington bureau chief there, looking at some of the top stories in national politics, including this vote yesterday to refer Mark Meadows, former Trump chief of staff, for charges of contempt. That goes to the Justice Department now. I want to listen to some of the text messages Meadows turned over to the committee. Republican Representative Liz Cheney shared some of the ones that Meadows received on January 6th. Here's one Fox News host, Laura Ingraham, sent to Meadows on January 6th.
Quote, Mark, the president needs to tell people in the Capitol to go home. This is hurting all of us. He is destroying his legacy, Laura Ingraham wrote.
Can you talk about that and some of the other messages that Representative Cheney shared as part of last night's proceedings?
Yeah, so this was one of the most striking things, was to hear all of these Fox News personalities trying to get Mark Meadows to tell Trump to stop the riot at the Capitol. And that seems to be some indication that they know that these people are Trump supporters and he has the power to stop it because they'll listen to him. And what's jarring about this is because it's so different than everything else we've been hearing on Fox News about how January 6th was a false flag attempt, about how these people were patriots. You know, this has nothing to do with Trump. Privately, clearly, we now know that these same Fox News hosts were contacting the White House and telling Trump, this is bad. You need to tell your people to cut it out. So again, it just goes against everything that they've been doing publicly and that they have irresponsibly been trying to fan the flames that this was no big deal when privately, you know, we saw that day that they were freaking out.
I want to give a listen now to Laura Ingraham responding on her show yesterday. Here is a listen.
Both publicly and privately, I said what I believe, that the breach of the Capitol on January 6th was a terrible thing. Crimes were committed. Some people were unfairly hounded and persecuted and prosecuted, but it was not an insurrection.
Some people have pointed to Art Ingraham pointing the fingers at Antifa on the evening of January 6th over the insurrection, though. What is the talk about the discrepancy you were mentioning, Amanda, between those private messages to Meadows and what came out in the media?
Yeah, I mean, you know, on January 6th, she said people who can only be there, it was perpetrated by people who can only be described as antithetical to the MAGA movement. Now, they were likely not all Trump supporters, and like you said, the Antifa stuff. You know, Sean Hannity said at the top of his January 6th show, I don't care. I don't know who they are. They're not people I would support. So, you know, sure, they're not saying like it's great to storm the Capitol, but they're also trying very, very, they never pinned the blame publicly on Trump. They never said that he should have stopped it sooner than he did. They didn't condemn the fact that he never really, you know, that his tweets didn't go very far. And if anything, just sort of, you know, sort of seemed to condone what these people were doing. When again, privately, they were telling Trump, this is really bad. You need to make a statement and stop it. Again, privately, conceding that he had some responsibility here.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Pleasant Prairie. Brad, hi.
Hi. I think if anybody knows anything about Donald Trump, he rules his domain with an iron fist. And I cannot for a second believe that all of these underlings did something without his express approval and support. The way he runs his business, it may be sloppy. He may not make money, but in some cases, but he is the absolute king.
Brad, thanks for the call. And that reminds me, Representative Cheney had also said at the hearings yesterday, Mr. Meadows' testimony will bear on another key question before this committee. Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceeding to count electoral votes? End quote. Is there a sense, as Brad was saying and as Representative Cheney was saying, that there's still efforts to look at former President Trump's responsibility for the events on January 6th?
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think, you know, a lot of this goes to the point Brad was making was, you know, all this stuff that Meadows is doing, for example, and cooperating, not cooperating. How much is he talking to Trump about this? How much does he have Trump's, you know, backing to stop cooperating? You know, same with Steve Bannon, same with these other officials. You know, how much is Trump pulling the strings and how nervous are they about running afoul of him? And I mean, and that's sort of the same issue that continues to come up as we see some of these documents. We saw that there was something from Mark Meadows saying that the military will be on standby to protect pro-Trump people, referring to January 6th. Now, there's not a lot of context around that. We don't know who he was talking to. We don't know exactly what it was about. But was that something Meadows was just saying? Was that something that came directly from the president? And so, yeah, you know, I think that's what people are looking at a lot on the committee is how much was Trump directly behind this?
Thanks for that call. Go to Jim now in Dubuque. Jim, hi.
Hi. Two issues. I wonder what your guest thinks of Representative Schiff presenting false information and showing some of the emails. He added things that weren't there in the original, and he left out a couple of paragraphs of continuation on one of the emails that put it in a better context. And I'm also wondering why they're resisting allowing this these subpoenas to be evaluated by the judicial system and the court when it may be that the whole procedure is illegitimate because they did not follow their own rules and allowed Nancy Pelosi to select the Republican representatives that they wanted.
Jim, thanks for the call. First of all, he's saying Representative Schiff had added or deleted information in some of the emails?
I'm not familiar what he's talking about there, but I'm happy to address the next part.
Sure.
So, you know, the Pelosi ended up choosing the Republicans because she tried to go forward with a bipartisan committee modeled after the 9/11 commission, which was also a bipartisan effort. And I believe the way it worked was that because Democrats are in the majority, they would have picked the chair and the Republicans would have picked the vice chair. They came up with legislation that was had the backing of some Republicans, and a Republican actually helped write the legislation, but then Republicans rejected it. And so Pelosi felt that she needed to go forward with some sort of commission to examine January 6th. So it ended up being a very partisan one because Republicans wouldn't support the bipartisan one, which again, members of their own party had worked on. And in terms of going to court, I mean, you know, Steve Bannon, he's been charged with two counts of criminal contempt of Congress. He's scheduled to stand trial on July 18th. The Justice Department will decide now whether they go forward with anything against Meadows or not. And then he will also face the judicial system. So, you know, these individuals are actually facing the justice system and they are going to trial if the Justice Department decides to pursue charges against them.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost with us today for a weekly roundup of the top stories in Washington. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Congress be in session on the anniversary of the January 6th insurrection? There's talk in Congress on whether they should be there or not, symbolically or for a normal business day. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at some of the top stories in national politics. Amanda Turkle stays with us from HuffPost. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234 on the January 6th committee and the Mark Meadows a referral for prosecution for not responding to the subpoena. Lisa is with us in Madison. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling in regard to Mark Meadows and the fact that not only was he using his personal phone, but he was sending texts via an app that only the users could unlock the text, the message, and that none of this had been sent to the National Archives. And that's also when Mark Meadows decided to stop cooperating when the requests were made for those. And the other interesting feature is so many people have wondered why Trump didn't send help for that 187 minutes. And based on text he sent the night before and that length of period of time, it almost seems that he was hoping counter protesters could show up and that would give him the ability in any ensuing violence to declare martial law.
Lisa, thanks for that call. First of all, Amanda, I think she's referring to the Signal app that Mark Meadows was using. And one of the texts sent to him and revealed by the Congressional Committee said something, 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 then check your Signal, apparently, for further communication.
Yes, right. That's what they, well, government officials and other government officials use it specifically to avoid open records requests. I mean, you know, Trump, what we're seeing come out of these documents is that, you know, it seems the fact that, you know, some officials try to say we didn't know what was going to happen, you know, this violence was appalling. It seems like they were well aware that there could be something like this. There was the former defense secretary who said in a January 3rd conversation with Trump that Trump has told him basically to do whatever was necessary to protect the demonstrators that were, you know, coming to Washington and coming to the Capitol. You know, Trump seemed aware that there was perhaps going to be some violence and something, and he wanted to use the military. He or his administration wanted to use the military to back them up, which, you know, we've seen him use the military in the past to clear out, you know, Lafayette Park right in front of the White House so he could walk across and do the photo op with the Bible. And so, you know, it's not surprising that he brought it up again.
Thanks for your calls on that issue. I want to move on to some other stories, including one, a related one you've been following, Amanda. What Congress is going to do on January 6th, 2022? What kind of things are members of Congress talking about?
So right now, the House is scheduled to be out of session and the Senate is scheduled to be in session. And lawmakers we've talked to seem a little bit torn about the messages this sends. Senator Susan Collins said that she would not be in session. She said, "You never know when someone may decide to mark the anniversary. I just think that day is too freighted with anxiety and anger, and it would just be better if we did not have any sort of anniversary of that day." You know, we talked to other senators who say we absolutely should be here. I talked to Congresswoman Susan Wild from Pennsylvania. She's a Democratic congresswoman. And I don't know if folks remember, but there was a picture of her lying on the ground looking like she was having a heart attack or a panic attack in the House gallery as the riot was underway. And she is part of this small group of lawmakers known as the gallery group, lawmakers who are stuck in there that day and they talk. And she said that she believes that they should be back to show that they weren't scared away. They're not afraid of coming back on January 6th. But there are other members who, you know, are quite traumatized by what happened even a year later and don't really want to be there. So there's a lot of talk about what will be done that day, if anything. And I think honestly, some Republicans are a little nervous that Democrats will use that day to remind people what happened, which, you know, doesn't always reflect well on them and their defense of Trump.
Talking to Amanda Turkle from HuffPost, looking at a few of the top stories in the nation's capital this week. A check-in, Amanda, on the Build Back Better package. This is part two of the spending packages supported by the Biden administration. The infrastructure one is a done deal now. The other one, the social safety net, climate change, other stuff. Seems like the situation hasn't changed that much. Where are we right now?
Well, today was a pretty messy day in the Senate, actually, on this. You know, the Senate has imposed a Christmas deadline. Democrats wanted to pass this by Christmas. honestly, right now, their big stumbling block is Joe Manchin. And today, he and Biden have been talking this week, and it doesn't seem like it's going all that well. There are now indications that Manchin, the Build Back Better legislation extends the child tax credit for 1 year. And the word was that this was a compromise because Senator Manchin wanted a work requirement attached. The rest of the Democrats said no. And so the compromise, okay, we'll just do it for one more year. But now Manchin is saying that he, supposedly saying that he doesn't want the child tax credit in the legislation at all. There's some concern that he thinks this is a budget gimmick to lower the cost, which again, he is the one who has wanted the cost lowered. And so I think Democrats are really frustrated that they feel like Manchin is a bit of a bad faith negotiator and there's no pleasing him. You know, the goalposts keep changing. Supporters of Manchin are saying, no, he's been clear all along that he wants the cost lower, but he doesn't want to. He also thinks Democrats should basically be doing fewer programs for longer. So the indications we're getting is this is not going to be happening by Christmas. It's going to be pushed into the new year. And then, honestly, I don't know if Democrats will have the appetite to keep fighting over this. They're going to need to turn their attention to the midterms. This is pretty messy, and it doesn't really seem to help them a lot at the ballot. So progress right now is a bit stalled.
Is there any sign of maybe a last-ditch effort to get in by Christmas, or does it seem like Senate leadership is starting to set people up to say, no, it's not going to happen by then?
They are still, you know, they are still working on it and they're still trying. But, you know, we had Senator Ron Wyden today concede that it's, you know, on the Finance Committee conceding that it will probably be next year. And so I think some people are getting frustrated. I think people aren't very hopeful because, again, it's just, you know, what they could do is if they can't reach a deal with Manchin is just put it on the floor and say, look, we're going to do this by Christmas. We're calling your bluff. Are you really going to be the one to vote against this and knock down this bill, or are you going to actually support it? And so that's one option, and you know that seems to be the only way because it doesn't seem like they're close to a deal with him right now.
And just our last minute or so, Amanda, a story you've been following: blockage in the Senate for many Biden appointees. Movement on that. It looks like with a Wisconsin connection, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett cleared a Senate committee in his appointments to an ambassadorship. What's been going on though with some blocked or at least delayed nominees?
Well, there have been some Republican senators. Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, Tom Cotton, Rand Paul, to name a few, who have been in various ways blocking Biden nominees. And they're all doing this through regular rules. But, you know, the Biden administration is getting frustrated. They have had 38% of their nominees confirmed. That's compared to 50% at this time for Trump, 68% for Obama. And so, you know, they're getting pretty frustrated that a lot of these nominees are being held up for unrelated reasons, policy differences, for example, with the administration, rather than allowing these folks to get a fair up or down vote based on their merits.
Amanda, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Been talking to Amanda Turkle. She's the Washington Bureau Chief for HuffPost. She was with us today for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics. You can follow breaking news at WPR.org and over at NPR.org, where they also have their eyes on the latest news from Congress. Coming up after the news, we'll find out how cranberry crops are being affected by climate change and what Wisconsin's growers can do about it. Some advice from a crop expert on how to deal with those bogs in the midst of a changing climate. You can follow these and other conversations anytime online at WPR.org, where you can live stream the Ideas Network and go into our archives to check out past conversations. Also, you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app so you can do those exact same things on your phone. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.